This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Really good stories, you see very memorable moments where strong characters are trying to overcome these situations.
I mean, that's why every protagonist needs his antagonist.
Yes.
Because they are opposites, as in the Batman movie. Joker says to Batman, "You complete me."
This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. Last month, on the third Friday, we started a series on conversations about the theatre, asking the question, what indeed is theatre? This week, we continue the conversation looking at the question, what is story in the context of theatre? And to throw some light on the question are Joe Kukitas and Zalfen Fuzi, both theatre practitioners. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Simple question, right?
It's a simple and yet fascinating question, right? Because stories don't really change and we all love stories.
Why is it we love stories?
Because we love mystery, we love secrets, we love lies, we want to know what happens. We all love Once Upon a Time. You want to know what happened once upon a time and then what happened after that. So I think when we ask what is story, story is always about a central character who you empathize with in some way, and then something happens to them. And that something is the beginning of the story. So in Jack and the Beanstalk, Jack discovers a beanstalk. In the Bond movies, Bond discovers that Blofeld wants to take over the world. And that something is usually a problem, and sometimes that problem is disguised to our hero as an opportunity. So, of course, he goes after it. And it usually throws our hero or our protagonist's world out of kilter. So, for example, then Alice falls down a rabbit hole. Jason Bourne finds out about a radical terrorist plot, and Godot just doesn't turn up.
Even that, we are interested to find out, why is he not there?
Yeah, because now the character has a problem and the character has to solve this problem. I mean, Alice has to find her way back home. Jason Bourne has to stop the bomb from going off. And Vladimir and Estragon, whether they like it or not, have to wait for Godot. They have no choice. And the story is their journey. They have to try to solve this problem. And along the way, they learn something about themselves. They overcome their obstacles. There's a moment near the end when we think, oh no, everything is lost. But then there'll be a resurrection of hope. Then there'll be a final battle against the odds. There'll be victory. There'll be defeat. And we will see all these things happening. And this is the shape of all stories. And there's a tragic counterpart, of course, as well, to the story. And there's a comedic counterpart. But it's the same basic shape of every story. Embedded deeply inside it, maybe sometimes.
In talking about stories, we can see how it flows.
Yes. I think that's why I like stories. I like stories because I like to see how people deal and overcome with their problem in their situation. Mm. Great plays are often about consequence. Something happens, which is what the Greeks define as climax, which is the point of no return. Mm. And the moment this incident happens, there's no going back. Therefore, a series of events have to take place which test and try the main characters and push them to their limits. And I love stories because I love seeing how people are pushed to the extreme and seeing how they have to overcome their situation. And great stories have that drama, and it's lovely to see how people deal with things and see how they have to overcome this big obstacle that they are faced with. And I think when you see really good stories, you see very memorable moments where strong characters are trying to overcome these situations.
I mean, that's why every protagonist needs his antagonist.
Yes.
Because they are opposites, as in the Batman movie. Joker says to Batman, "You complete me."
Yes.
So the hero is always looking for the other person to complete him because that person is the opposite. And then there's going to be some sort of conflict.
So using Joseph Campbell's book as the way to organize things is that we are actually listening to the same story, the hero with a thousand faces. So all these stories can be, in a sense, put into this box.
Yeah, I think all theatre and all stories actually are about human desire, right? Everybody
yeah.
must want something. I think the novelist Kurt Vonnegut used to say that when he used to teach writing to his students, he used to tell them all the time, your characters must desire something. You know, even if they just desire a glass of water, they must desire something. And of course, Stanislavski articulated this in theatre when he talked about the objectives of the theatre. But if you think about it, in the Knights of the Round Table, they only come alive when they know that there is a Holy Grail. Now they have to go and find it, right? And so then we follow the story because those characters have a desire.
Can we talk about story in terms of, use an example like in Macbeth? What does Macbeth want?
Well, I think the important thing is that it's the kind of person he is.
Yeah.
It's not about what he wants first. First, you must know the kind of person he is. What you want tells us, the audience, the kind of person you are. I mean, Chekhov used to say, tell me what you want and I will tell you what manner of man you are. So what manner of man is Macbeth?
Well, Macbeth is a power-hungry, ruthless man who will do whatever it takes to get power.
Ah, but is he? Or is he a brave general who has within him the flaw of being ambitious?
Yes.
Right? Because he is a brave general. That's also something which we mustn't forget about him. But his flaw is his hidden ambition, his secret desire, his secret ambition.
Yes.
And then when he meets the witches, of course, the witches tell him, you know, you are going to be this great
right.
king.
So that stirs him along.
Pushes him along
the path. But that's his mistake that he makes, because he misunderstands what they say. He only hears the outcome of it. He doesn't know the bloody path to it.
Yes.
And of course, his wife is ambitious.
His wife is, yeah.
And she also
motivating him as well.
Motivates him and stirs up his ambition. And in fact, when he doesn't want to go and murder Duncan, she berates him.
To,
yes,
yeah.
Ambition should be made of sterner stuff, she says to
yes.
him, right?
And that's from Julius Caesar, right? Yeah. No, that's from Julius Caesar. Ambition should be made of sterner stuff.
It's from Julius Caesar?
Yeah, yeah.
What does she say? Oh, then screw your courage
to the sticking place. Yeah, but you called him, are you a man?
Yeah.
Are you afraid? That's the conflict. Is it a conflict between himself or him and what's been told to him, him and his wife? Zalfen, you say every story has this conflict.
Yes.
Well, there are many different conflicts. I think maybe Zalfen can explain the various conflicts that there must be present for a drama to take place.
You know, they say all stories are just variations of really five basic plots. And all these plots are based on conflict. So, for example, you have man versus man. Man versus man is basically one man against another person, like in Romeo and Juliet, the two different families conflicted, or in Twelfth Night, or even a movie like Gladiator, right? Then you've got man versus society. Antigone is a good example, or even The Crucible, where an individual against what the rest of society believes, and they're fighting for that cause.
Public enemy.
Public enemy of the people,
yes, called.
Exactly. In Hamlet and Macbeth, it's man versus himself, because they're trying to deal with all of their own internal issues and trying to overcome that. And then you have man versus fate. A great example is Oedipus, or Waiting for Godot, or even No Exit. These are all very famous plays about man versus fate. And finally, man versus nature.
But I suspect they're not pure in the sense that, you know, in a play that you just see man versus man, but you sometimes see man versus society, and there's one particular individual also, yeah?
Well, you've got the main plots, you've got subplots, right? And I think that's what makes very good stories, when you have many layers to it, right?
There are many conflicts within the one play. It's not just one conflict per play.
And I suppose one must dominate.
Not necessarily. I think a skillful writer can hold many conflicts within one play. In fact, I think a good play has many conflicts within it, because the character himself may be conflicted with his choices, but he's in conflict with somebody else who wants another series of choices. And there may be a greater society outside him who wants other things from him. And then, of course, he may also then be fighting against his destiny. So if you look at a play like Oedipus, which I think Oedipus is another great example of all these things, here is a man who, when he's born, the prophecy is that he will kill his father and marry his mother.
Yeah.
So, of course,
He fights that.
Well, no, he doesn't fight it because he doesn't know about it. His parents think, well, we don't want this. The father thinks, I don't want my son to kill me. The mother thinks, I don't want my son to sleep with me. So they send him into the woods to be killed. But, of course, as often happens in these tales about going into the woods, to feel, we can't kill an innocent baby. So he's brought up elsewhere and then becomes a strong and courageous man who decides to travel to this faraway country because a sphinx is terrorizing that neighborhood. He kills the sphinx, is made a hero, goes into the city, hailed as a hero, kills his father, marries his mother. But when he finds out what he's done, when he finds out the woman he loves is his mother, it's unbearable, and he blinds himself.
Yes. Right?
That's when he realizes that actually it was the gods all along. It was his destiny all along.
It's
and he
fate.
Cannot confront it. It's fate.
Yes.
But in the meantime, he's had conflicts with a man. He's had conflicts with society. And now he's conflicted with himself. The only way to then deal with it is to not see it any longer. It's too painful. It's too difficult.
Interestingly enough, because he pierces his eyes outright, like you say, because it's too painful to watch. And this whole Freudian thing is that our eyes and nose represent the male genitalia and the mouth of the female, of course.
Right.
So that is, in a sense, an emasculation of him. Yeah.
Well, of course, that's why we also have the Oedipus complex, which is when your young man loves his mother in a slightly unnatural way. But I think it's also this idea of human desires is very important, that a character in a play must want something. They must want something specific, like Romeo wants Juliet. The two characters in Waiting for Godot want Godot. But of course, we also want other things, love, home, belonging, friendship, self-esteem, survival. These are all the big wants that are necessary for a play to work, because that's what we want as human beings as well.
Must the conflict be something very monumental?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's usually very dramatic, right? We have this term called raising the stakes, basically, to see how far will a character go to achieve what it is that they want. And ultimately, the higher the stakes, the more dramatic it is. A lot of young playwrights who deal with this issue of how do you raise the stakes. You want to see how much they want to fight for something and how far they want to die for something. Yeah. And great stories have that.
We always tell our students, you know, if you want to write a play, put your characters through hell.
Yes.
Because if you put them through hell, then you will figure out what they're made of and how they will respond to those obstacles, to the hell that they inhabit. But hell isn't necessarily, you know, dragons. Hell is sometimes very internal, how you deal with grief, how you deal with death.
I'm speaking with Joe Kukitas and Zalfin Fuzi, theatre practitioners whose experiences extend from creating a theatre company to writing and directing and teaching workshops. We are talking theatre and in particular responding to the question, what is story? Coming up, more on the topic. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. You're tuned to Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. Last month, we started the first conversation on our series about the theatre. We continue this month asking the question, what is story? And with me are two theatre practitioners, Joe Kukitas and Zalfin Fuzi.
More traditional stories, the folks are always like, say, fighting dragons. But if you look at Oedipus, he's like, in a sense, fighting the gods. There are large themes. But for today, are there that kind of conflicts that are equally monumental?
Of course. I mean, I think that we haven't stopped fighting with God. I think, in fact, in a way, all the existential plays of this century, and I think Zafia named No Exit in Sartre's work or the work of Ionesco, I mean, these are all plays which are saying, what is the purpose? Where is God? Who are we? These are questions which never go away. They are couched in different forms, but the essential questions that we ask as human beings, I don't think has really changed.
You know, some have said, like for instance, you say if they have not changed, something like death of a salesman, the conflict seems so much smaller, let's say, compared to King Lear or Hamlet.
It's only smaller to Lear, but to Willy Loman, it's not small at all. For Willy Loman, living the death of the dream, it's huge. I mean, you've believed all your life in this American dream, and then you come to the end of your life. I think it's very much like Lear. He's in a storm as well. His storm is maybe not physical rain and wind and heath, but it is a huge storm that blows his life apart.
Look at one of the most classic plot lines, or you look at the most classic premise of a story, like good triumphs over evil. This is what Star Wars is all about. And that's a new story, right? I mean, that just came out recently, but it's the most classic storyline, good triumphs over evil. And that's an epic battle between the good guys and the bad guys. Or even another classic storyline, love conquers all. There are millions of stories about love and how love is the greatest thing and it'll solve everything.
And at the same time, the classical stories that we love, whether it's Shakespeare or the Greek plays or the Mahabharata or you know, whatever, from whatever culture, the characters that we are interested in are not just the ones who are battling the outer demons, but the ones who are battling the inner demons. The internal characteristic about what the character needs to overcome their own flaw is what makes us interested. So Othello is jealous. He has a jealous nature. Is he going to get past this feelings of rage and jealousy? As we said, Macbeth is ambitious. Is he going to be able to tame his ambition? Lear is vain and proud. And it's because of these, because they're fully realized characters, they have to go on a journey to overcome this weakness and find their flaws. For Lear, it is on the heath because he must lose everything. He must go mad. He must, again, go into the woods, go into the darkness to find out anything and come back.
So no different from Luke Skywalker, even though he saves the whole empire. The first major step is overcoming himself.
Yeah. I just think that maybe some of the characters in Shakespeare may be slightly better drawn. That's all. But that's my personal opinion. I think we see them as much more complex characters than maybe Luke Skywalker. Sorry, Star Wars fans. We love Star Wars as well, but I think it's a different level of complexity and humanity that we see, because we see their suffering, we see their vulnerability, and I think that's what compels us as well.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this element of that we see this individual, we identify with this individual, and this individual struggle to be something more than he is or she is at the start of the play or the start of the story.
Well, I think that's why we meet characters and they seem quite benign. Yeah. They're just like you and me, and then something happens.
Yes.
And that's what we call the inciting incident, right? Something happens, and how they deal with this that happens that then determines the rest of the play. After that, it's all going to start escalating. So, for example, in Macbeth, you can see there are two different inciting incidents. Is one inciting incident the meeting with the witches, but the other inciting incident is once Macbeth decides to kill Duncan.
Yeah.
I mean, he talks a lot before he kills him, but once he kills him, there is, as Alfian says, absolutely no going back. And the rest of the plot unfolds, and it's wonderfully unfolds structurally, because there is no other thing that can happen. You kill the king, all those who are loyal to the king are going to do something about it at some point.
They're coming after you.
Yeah, and we are just watching how.
Yes.
And that's why we're excited. We know the outcome, because if you're going to do something like that, this is going to be your comeuppance.
You have to pay.
You have to pay the price.
Yes.
I think that's what makes stories so compelling, right? Is that sense of change. Things are always changing, and it's always dynamic, and you never know where it's going. Mm. Good playwrights keep you on your toes.
And the good playwright will then, for that character, still create another crisis. So I think in Macbeth, for example, the crisis is the death of Lady Macbeth. So when she dies, Macbeth is in crisis. He says she should have died hereafter. One of the most melancholy lines, I think, in Shakespeare is tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And I think after she dies, I think everything in him changes, because he now has to still keep going. He has no choice.
He has no choice.
But I think he's kind of lost the taste for it a little bit. And that's when he redeems himself in our eyes, because now he has to go forward. He has no choice. And it's about now his bravery, because he knows the outcome, but now he's going to be brave about it anyway. And then we feel, you know what? He made a bad choice, and now he's going to pay for it, but we watch him pay.
Huh. How interesting. Some have seen him just as this villain. I mean, we don't see him at the start like a Luke Skywalker or...
Oh, but he is a Luke Skywalker at the beginning. That's why you have the character of the soldier at the very beginning, who comes in and says, you should have seen him on those battlements. You should have seen
the things he did.
He's presented from the very beginning as a hero.
But we don't see him...
That's not the point. I mean, all of Shakespeare, actually, he always does this. He has all these messengers come in, or Cleopatra Enobarbus comes on and says, my God, that Cleopatra on her barge, what a babe. Wow, even the winds stopped blowing in, because they were lovesick with her. And same with the soldier at the beginning of Macbeth. He comes in and says, I'm completely exhausted, but I can't stop talking about that fella.
Yeah.
Because he's so amazing. And so when we first meet him, we think, wow, this is that guy. He's been set up in our mind as a hero. And then we meet him, we're like, okay, he seems a bit scared. He seems a bit spooked. But we still cannot get away from the fact that we watch him now through the lens of the soldier.
Well, that's the whole point of change, right? Because you flip it, and good playwrights will flip it. They will challenge every assumption that you have about a situation, about a character or an event. And by flipping it, it just turns your world upside down, doesn't it? And that's what makes it so exciting.
Are stories all told, it's kind of a neat and tidy ending. Like, you know, as you said, once upon a time, you know, this princess, she's saved, or that this guy does something, and in the end, this triumph. Are stories kind of neatly packaged for us today?
No, I don't think so. I think no story that's worth its salt goes back to the beginning. It's not once upon a time and then it all came back to the beginning. It's everything changes. Stories are about change, and something ends up different from the beginning and at the end. Some stories have happy endings, I suppose, but most theatre doesn't have much truck with happy endings in that sense, but it's all about change.
Yeah. Structurally, it's just kind of tying the loose ends and trying to see, okay, this is how it was in the beginning. Now that this has happened, and now we've come through that process, and now that we've overcome that process, we're now here, you know, just tying loose ends. And what we call it basically the falling action, or the conclusion, or how we wrap things up.
The word denouement, the English word comes from the French word denouer, which means to untie. So essentially all it's doing is all the knots of the plot are undone, untied, and all the complications are undone, so that we can see clearly the unraveling.
Are there points to stories? We have to kind of talk about change.
Well, I think Anne Bogart, the American director, said something interesting some years ago about telling stories in postmodern modern society. And she said telling a story is about building a bridge. It's about empathy. And of course, there was a long period of deconstruction in postmodern theatre in America. So I'm talking very specifically about how she sees it. And stories are cultural. So she felt it's the end of deconstructed theatre for America, she feels, post 9/11. She argues that post 9/11, we are in need of construction, right? Not deconstruction. And I remember like many years ago, I did this workshop at the Royal Court for writers and directors. And all the stories that the writers from the West wanted to tell were all deconstructed stories, completely deconstructed stories. And all of us from the East, and by East I mean people from Czechoslovakia, from the Balkan nations, from India, myself from Malaysia, people from Kenya, Spain, we all wanted to tell stories which constructed a reality because that's what our societies needed. We did not need deconstruction. But Anne Bogart argues that now in the West, they need construction again because we need to build bridges. We need to build bridges. We need to have empathy. We need to cross that bridge and meet somebody equally on the other side.
You use the term deconstructed stories. What do you mean by that?
Postmodern theatre, where the plot is taken apart, where you have a series of images perhaps to tell you a fragmented story. But even then, it's not just that. I think it's a kind of the way of telling us, it's anti-story maybe in a way. I mean, my favourite way of looking at stories, which is about going into the woods. And one of my favourite books on writing is actually by John York, which is called Into the Woods, How Stories Work and Why We Tell Them. And my other favourite book is Margaret Atwood's Negotiating with the Dead, where she talks about the writer or the artist or the musician, in this case it's Orpheus, going into the underworld, that we need to go into the underworld. And in fact, Plato writes about it all the way back in his time when he has his metaphor of the cave, that in the cave there are all these people who only know the cave. They do not know the outside world. But at some point, somebody ventures out and says, oh my God, there's something outside this cave. And they come back and say, hey guys, there's this other world outside the cave. And of course, everybody thinks that person is mad. So that's what theatre is. That's what stories do. The storyteller goes out, sees the reality, and goes back and tries to tell everybody that's what actually is really going on. Most people think that person is mad.
And by telling that story, you build a bridge to the person who's listening to the story.
In some way, you try to show them that another reality exists outside the ones that they know. Because a lot of the time, we are living in a cave. And I think with artists, what we're trying to show is we're trying to show that there is a life outside that cave. And It's scary to go outside. It's scary to go into the woods to discover what's inside there. We come to terms with ourselves in the wood. I think that's why the Sondheim musical works so beautifully. Because All these people who go into the wood are tested. They find out who they really are. And then they come back and they come out changed.
So all these stories are telling us, be bold, step out of your cave, be open to change.
I do think stories are telling us that. They're reflecting. That's exactly what happens in our lives. Our lives are full of change. Change, death, loss, grief. And I think stories are important because they show this back to us in a way that we can empathize and feel.
They help us.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're necessary, aren't they?
Yes, definitely.
Like you said, you know, stories are to build bridges and in some ways perhaps build bridges for ourselves. Yeah. In seeing our own lives in a way reflected. I guess even for theatre practitioners, I understand, for instance, this becomes a way of working through for yourself to find meaning in life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because based on what I understand of some of these theatre groups like Odin and their own history, those folks were living the theatrical life not as something that we perform for people, but as a way of finding purpose.
Well, I think the important thing is that they are trying to find story, right? So they're learning craft. And I think that I will go back to Zalfian's very good question at the beginning, which is what is story? Because what is story is about actually a question about craft. And theatre making and plays are all about crafting things. In John York's book, he says, storytelling is an indispensable human preoccupation, as important to all of us almost as breathing. From the mystical campfire tale to the explosion in the post-television age, it dominates our lives. So we need to try to understand it. And a lot of the time, we don't want to try to understand the craft of it. You know, and I'm very keen on people thinking about the craft of storytelling. Yeah. And I think Delacroix said this, first learn to be a craftsman. It won't keep you from being a genius. because you have to craft a story. It doesn't just arise suddenly. Understanding all these components, what makes a story work, and that's why we love to read books about what makes stories work, because we're trying to figure it out. We're trying to figure out the craft of it. Once you know the craft of it, then it can move somebody else. It's not to move us. We learn this craft so we can create it so other people can be moved. I always tell my students, it's like making a place, like making a table. You need to make something that somebody can use. They can put a glass on it and it won't fall off. And then when you get better at making that table, then eventually you can make a more beautiful table or a table which in some way excites people in a different kind of way. But first, you've got to learn to build that table where somebody can put a glass on it without it falling off and shattering.
Well, I mean, I think that's what theatre is all about. It's about that shared experience.
Yes.
So it goes back to the theatre maker sharing something with the audience, right? And in this case, if it's telling a good story, a good crafted story, that's the whole point, right? So that the audience can come into that world and share that experience with you. And we talk about what is story, but theatre specifically is a performed narrative which is unfolding in an empty space. And just going back to last week's show where we talked about, you know, what is theatre,
yes.
Right? It's that empty space, so telling that story and giving that performance in an empty space, which is what makes theatre so special.
So I suppose today really what we're talking about is we're talking about the playwright, because the playwright is the one not wholly responsible but partly responsible for putting that story inside that space or creating the story that the director and the actors will then perform in that space. But the playwright plays a very important role in theatre. I mean, Arthur Miller said the playwright is a litmus paper of the arts. He's got to be, because if he isn't working on the same wavelength as the audience, no one would know what the hell he was talking about. So he's a kind of psychic journalist of the times. And that's what the playwright has to be. He has to try to understand the time he lives in. He has to understand the story that needs to be told. I think that's very important. Different places, different times need different kinds of stories. So now we have to ask, what kind of story do we need right now?
In Malaysia.
In Malaysia, in the world. You know, we're global citizens as well as citizens of the country. And I think that maybe that's why Anne Bogart seemed to feel that we need those bigger stories again, perhaps.
So what does the playwright provide? They provide the text, and the text is essentially the story, right? But in theatre, the text is just one component of the performance. There's so much more that is telling the story. There's textual, and then there's, of course, there's subtext. And then there's also movement in space and time. There's design.
There's sound.
There's music. There's costume design. There's set design. Mm-hmm. So all of these things are then added layers which are telling the story. So from the basis of what the playwright is providing, which is the text.
I think that's such a good point, actually, because sometimes you see theatre and the only thing that the company is doing is that they're giving you text.
Yeah.
They're not giving you subtext. They're not giving you any other sense of story through the other elements.
Yeah.
So you may have sound and set design and all that, but I've seen theatre where those elements are not telling the story.
Yeah.
And in fact, they always, everything, costume, makeup, set, must all tell the story as well. They all play their part in telling it, and particularly subtext.
Yes.
What's not being said.
What's not being said, yeah.
I guess as theatre people, we love subtext.
Yeah.
More than we love text, maybe even.
And the subtext is to be filled in by
the audience? But no, I mean,
it must
be understood by the actor.
Yeah, it's what's implied, it's what's inferred. It's misdirection sometimes. You know, you can say yes, but actually you mean no, right, for instance. So it's the hidden meaning or the meaning underneath the words that are actually being said.
Which actually comes to a very important point about words, because I think the words are the magic of theatre. They have their own alchemy. They have their own power because it's not what they necessarily say, but it's also what they don't say. So that's why the invisible hand in the word is very, very beautiful and very powerful.
Well, we have said enough words for today, and I hope in all of this there is also the subtext of where the audience can come in and see what has been created for them and what they can take from the plays that I've presented to them. I've been speaking with Joe Kukadas and Zafin Fuzi, theatre practitioners whose experiences extend from creating a theatre company to writing and directing and teaching workshops. We've been talking theatre and in particular responding to the question, what is story in the context of a performance? Coming up next month, we'll talk more about the theatre and what it offers to us. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.